During these three Sunday mornings, we're studying Psalms 22, 23, and 24, which go together as a trinity and are a lovely preparation for Easter. They are also a preparation for those of you who, by God's grace, will be in His land this very Wednesday. And I'm sure that that visit will mean more to you because we've been through these Psalms. There is a paraphrase of the psalm on a grey sheet of paper in front of you, and an outline of what I want to say. And I warn you that I've found more in this psalm than I've found in the other two. So we'll have a little break for song in the middle. Psalm 24. The God of the Jews owns this planet with everything in it and everyone on it. Because He built up the land from the bed of the ocean and sent down the water that flows in its rivers. But who could climb to His holy height? And who could stay in His perfect presence? Only one whose conduct was faultless and whose character was flawless, who had not based his life on things which don't ring true, and who had never broken his word. Such a man would be given attention and approval by the God who saved him. For people like this really want to find God and meet Him face to face, as Jacob did. Pause for a moment and think about yourself. Fling wide the city gates. Open up those old citadel doors. His magnificent majesty is about to enter. Who is this marvelous monarch? The powerful God of the Jews, the undefeated God of the Jews. Fling wide the city gates, open up those old citadel doors. His magnificent majesty is about to enter. Who is this marvelous monarch? The God who commands all the forces of the universe. That's who this marvelous monarch is. Be quiet for a while and think about Him. Now, Psalms 22, 23, and 24 are a sandwich in much the same way as 1 Corinthians 12, 13, and 14 are a sandwich. And in both cases, most people lick the jam out of the middle, because it's sweet. And whereas many people know Psalm 23 and could probably recite it backwards, Psalm 24 is not so well known and certainly not so popular. Its theme is not so sweet. And so we lick the jam out and we leave the two pieces of bread on either side. But if I may return to last Sunday mornings for one moment, to the sheep and their shepherd, I read you from that letter I quoted last Sunday morning from a shepherd who gave me two illustrations from his work for my work. And the second was this. He talked about a ewe that is blind because for some reason she hadn't been eating enough of the right food. On top of this, the lambs she's carrying are growing so rapidly during the last month of pregnancy, she's had to convert her own body resources to provide energy for herself and them. Because she's not getting enough carbohydrates, the fat breakdown is incomplete and poisonous toxins are built up. One of the early symptoms is blindness, which in turn affects further feeding and accelerates the problem. Now, that's what happens when you don't get enough carbohydrates. And if you lick the jam out of Psalm 23 and don't take the carbohydrates of Psalm 22 and Psalm 24, then you will be blind to further truth. So we're going to tell it as it is and eat the whole sandwich. You see, the general theme of Psalm 22 is pain, and that is mentally disturbing. We don't like to think about pain. The general theme of Psalm 23 is an atmosphere of peace and green pastures and still waters. Ah, now that's a little more congenial. We like that. The theme of Psalm 24 is purity, and that's morally disturbing. And so we're mentally disturbed by Psalm 22, we're morally disturbed by Psalm 24, but Psalm 23, oh, that's nice. That's comforting. As long as we just switch off slightly when we talk about the valley of the shadow and the paths of righteousness. But Psalm 24 comes in to complete the sandwich. And that puts the whole thing in context, as we shall see. Now, the three psalms, I've said, are basically related. They're a balanced diet for the sheep, if you like. They've got the sweetness, but they've got the carbohydrates. So let's look at the way they relate. The theme of Psalm 22 was a judicial execution, a cross. The theme of Psalm 23 was a pastoral occupation, the crook. The theme of Psalm 24 is a ceremonial coronation, a crown. And these are the three dimensions that give us a beautiful, deep view of Jesus Christ. The cross, the crook, and the crown. And they are in the right order, too. You come to the cross first. You have his crook laid upon you second. And one day you'll share his glory and wear a crown third. So that relates the theme. And we're going to look at our Lord first as Savior, which we did 2 weeks back. Then as shepherd, which we did last week, and now as sovereign. Who is this King of Glory? Now, at first sight, Psalm 24 is a bit of a hodgepodge. Did you get that impression? In fact, the psalmist himself realized that, and he split it into a number of songs, and he said, Selah, in the middle. Did you ever know what that meant? Nobody actually knows. Scholars have just guessed at it. I've even seen one who thought it was what David said when he broke a guitar string. I'm quite sure that's not the right one. But I think the meaning that certainly clicks with me is the meaning that scholars say, pause, stop, think about that. Just give a little time to let that sink in, because we're going to move on to something else. And if you rush on too quickly without thinking about it, then you could lose the challenge of what you've just read. And this particularly applies where the word Selah comes in twice here. There's a very deep challenge to every one of us in the middle of the psalm. And then it says, Selah, before you rush on, stop, pause, wait a moment, think about it. And then it moves on to a totally different vision of the Lord in all his glory. When you get to the end of that, it says, now don't rush on to the next item of worship. Stop. Think about that too. And let it sink in. So it's not a hodgepodge, but it is a variety. We've moved from the worm's eye view in Psalm 22 to a bird's eye view in Psalm 24. And we're now looking at the whole world. We're looking at the whole human race. It has become less personal. There is no I, no me in this psalm. We are looking now out at our world, out at the human race, and up to God. It's more objective. And it's good to be taken out of yourself. Last week, many of you were touched at points of personal need. You've told me. Some of you have told me since last Sunday you've been through a valley of deep shadow this week. And the shepherds saw you through. But this week we're not preoccupied with ourselves, except insofar that we shall do a bit of self-examination. We're going to finish up looking at the Lord and the King of Glory. And that's a very healthy thing for us to do. Now, a zoom lens is a familiar object to us now. I haven't got one. I wish I had. They're great things for photographers. And it's as if the psalmist had a zoom lens, and he zooms in from a wide picture which includes the whole earth, a shared place for all people to live in, and then he zooms in on one hill, a holy hill, which is a special place where some people can go. And then he zooms right in to one place, the glorious gates of a citadel, the supreme place for one man to live in. So there's a kind of zooming in, and that gives you the thread between the three parts of the psalm, which otherwise might not hang together in your mind. We're starting with a broad landscape. We're zooming in on a hill, and then we're focusing on one set of doors on that hill, which opens up a very special place for just one man. And the key word in this psalm, and I've taught you many times to look for key words. Did you notice it in this psalm? The key word which will unlock the whole psalm and its meaning for you. If you got this word, you could go away and do all this sermon for yourself. It's a word of three letters. Who? Who? Now, of the three sections in the psalm, the question is not asked of the broad landscape, because it doesn't need to be asked. He doesn't begin, "Who shall live in the earth and the fullness thereof?" Because we know perfectly well who lives there. 4,000 million people live there in 1976. You don't need to say who lives in that place. It's shared by all men. But when you zoom into that special hill, you've got to ask the question, who's going to go there? And when you zoom further in on those special gates, you've got to say, and who is going to go through those gates? So the key word here and the key question is who? And you've got to answer that question. In the second part, you've got to ask whether you will be among the who of that second section. And in the third, we've got to ask, and who will ultimately be the king in this world of ours? Who will ultimately reign? Well, you know the answer to that one already. So let's look at verses 1 to 2. I've called it the established earth, a shared place for all. And we all live in it. The question here is not who's going to be in it, but who owns it. This is the big question. Who owns it? And the answer comes very emphatically in the Hebrew language. When you want to underline a word, you don't underline it. You put the word at the beginning of the sentence. And whatever word comes first in a sentence in Hebrew is the word that's underlined. And in Hebrew, it doesn't say, the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof, because that would make the earth most important. In Hebrew, it says, Lord's is the earth. Lord's is the earth. So in my paraphrase, I've reversed it. The God of the Jews owns this planet. He's the owner. But he is not fully the occupier. But he's the owner. Now the implications of these few words, the earth is the Lord's, are staggering. And when I began to write them down, the sheer implications of those few words, I realized I could preach a whole series of sermons on the implications and still never exhaust them. The first one that hit me hard was the religious implication of those words. We are now in a day when it is assumed that there should be tolerance between all religions and that the religion that fits that culture is best for those people. And so there is now the general idea that Allah is the best God for the Arabs. And Jehovah is the best God for the Jews, and the Hindu gods are the best gods for the Indians. And we should be tolerant of one another and not interfere with one another's culture. Stay with your own religion, don't spread it. Don't be fooled, other religions aren't taking that attitude. Behind the 3-month exhibition of the World of Islam in London is a direct evangelistic desire to make Britain Muslim. If you read your Times this week, you'd know that. It's not a cultural thing. Behind it is a direct attempt to introduce another religion to British people in this country and not just to Pakistani immigrants. And the Queen opened it. And the Bishop of Guildford has written a very controversial report saying we should be favorable to Islam. But there's just one simple answer to all that. The earth is the Lord's. God is not English, and he's not middle class, and he's not Western. He's not even Jewish. His son is, because there was a Jewish mother. But God is not even Jewish. The earth is the Lord's. He owns the whole planet, and that's why Christianity is both universal and exclusive. It's got to be taken everywhere, and it can never be mixed with another religion, and it can never be tolerant of another religion. There is only one God, the I Am. In fact, the Hebrew here says, I Am owns this planet. It's all His. And God is no more the exclusive property of the English or the Americans than He is of the Chinese or the African or the South American. Woe betide us if we overlook the implication for religion. David Frost did a very satirical program on television, a takeoff of Which magazine, comparing the various religions and what they offered you and what snags there were and how many blobs you gave it and so on. He was just highlighting that people are shopping around now. They'll try anything. Meditation from the East, yoga from the East, try anything. But the earth is the Lord's, and the God of the Jews is the only God who exists. And therefore, not only is He the only God for us, He's the only God for everybody else. And we have just got to take this message to the whole earth. If it simply said He was the God of the Holy Land, that would be a different matter. Every land is His land already. Every land. England is His land. And fishermen talk with Him by the great North Sea, as the hymn puts it. Every land is His land. The earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. He's not foreign anywhere. But there are other implications as well. The political one comes next. Think of the political implications of the first sentence, the earth is the Lord's. As I looked at my daily newspapers this week, every place where there was serious trouble was over one question only, who the land belonged to. Northern Ireland, Lebanon, Angola, Rhodesia, you name it, wherever there is trouble, it's because one group is saying it's ours, it's mine. And another group is saying it isn't. We got here first. It's the atheist and agnostic who think that the earth is up for grabs. But it isn't. It already belongs to someone. There is no such thing as freehold. Even if your solicitor tells you you've got freehold, you haven't. The Lord could take it from you tonight. You fool, tonight your soul will be required of you and you'll leave it behind. Freehold? You've only got it leasehold. You're not the landlord, you're the tenant. Nobody owns this world. The earth is the Lord's. And there was a time in Britain when this influenced our political outlook and decisions. That time has long since gone, alas. In 1851, they opened the Great Exhibition in London. It was an exhibition of what we were able to produce and what we'd done, an exhibition of our culture. Now it's the Islamic culture that's exhibited in London, but then it was British. We had something we could exhibit. And you know what the motto for that exhibition was? There it was on the notepaper and above the exhibition. The earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. When they built the Royal Exchange in the City of London, where men scurry with their bowler hats and rolled up umbrellas and briefcases to exchange thousands of pounds, there it is written on the Royal Exchange. How many of them look up and read it before they go to the office each day? The earth is the Lord's. And whatever part of it you handle this morning, it's His you're handling. Not yours. Whether it be shares, whether it be property, whatever it be, the earth is the Lord's. The political implications. If only you could get the warring factions in Lebanon and Northern Ireland just to sit down and agree on one thing, that Lebanon is the Lord's, that the Northern Ireland is the Lord's, and start there, and then ask Him how much of it He wants them each to have. Can you imagine the transformation there would be on the world scene if we could do that? If Jew and Arab could sit down and just say it's the Lord's, which part does He want us to have? Because I'm sure the Lord wants the Arabs to have a home as well as the Jews. And in Acts 17, Paul in Athens said, God has allotted the boundaries of habitations of the nations. God has planned it all out. He's drawn the atlas up. It's because we don't listen to Him and we grab, grab, grab. We forget that it's His to begin with. In the long run, all the land we'll get will be what God allows us. And if we try to get more than He allows us, we'll finish up with less than we started with. It's not just Hitler that learned that. Britain has learned that too. The earth is the Lord's. And then two little codicils are added. First, everything it produces and all its people. Now again, think of the implications of that. This earth, says the psalm, is fullness. It's full. And if you've ever seen pictures of the moon or of Mars, have you noticed how empty it is? This is the only planet in the entire universe, as far as we know, that can support life, because it's full. It's teeming with minerals, vegetables, animals. It's full. Because it's full, 4,000 million people can live on this tiny little speck of interstellar dust. And all that belongs to God. Can you imagine what would happen if Iceland and Britain sat down and said, the cod between us belongs to the Lord? And then they prayed about it and said, Lord, what do we do about your cod? Can you imagine if we felt that North Sea oil and gas was not ours, but his? Or if the Arabs thought of all the black gold underneath their desert sands, oil, as his, not ours? The world would be a very different place. You see, God didn't put minerals evenly through the world. He put gold and platinum in South Africa, not to make South Africa rich, not to enable them to hold out militarily against others, not to make them better than any other country, but to give them something to share with the whole world. See, God gives you something to share with other people. And the biggest difference that comes when you grasp this first verse is that you don't talk about your rights anymore, you talk about your responsibilities. You don't think about what you can grab, you think of what you can share with those who haven't got that in their land. And those with valuable minerals on their property will say, now those people over there don't have that, so we must share. They have something that we don't have, so they share. Do you see? The world was meant to be operated as one economic unit with one owner, and the problem is that it's not. It's operated by hundreds of owners, each thinking that what they've managed to grab is theirs as a bargaining point. The earth is the Lord's, all its produce, and all its people, all its people. Whether they be rich or poor, clever or simple, black or white, whatever they be. They all belong to him in one sense. There is another in which they don't. But there is a sense in which they do. Which means simply that every person is at God's disposal. My life is not my own to do with what I want. It never has been. If I do that, I will pay the bill. My life belongs to him. And as soon as I find what he planned for it, then I'll find the fulfillment for which I seek. Because I belong to him and he planned a life for me, which would be for him. My main object in being on earth is for him, not me. I belong to him. And my ultimate destiny is in his hands, and he will do with me what he decides. All the people in it belong to him. This would be a revolution if we didn't study any other verse this morning, but took this and just worked through its spiritual implications, its political implications, its social implications, its economic implications. Why, I could produce a manifesto for the next election just on this one verse. It wouldn't get many votes. But there's a whole manifesto here. It all belongs to him. Why? What reason has he to claim such rights and give me only responsibilities? What right have you, Lord, to say this? Why does it all belong to you? Why do I belong to you? Why do all the minerals belong to you? And God just says, well, two reasons, and I think they're good enough and beyond dispute. One, I made it. Two, I manage it. Is that good enough? One, I made it. There would be no land to live on unless he had literally, as it says here in Psalm 24, raised up dry land from the bed of the ocean. Now remember that this is a pre-scientific era in which this was stated. And remember that at the top of the Swiss Alps you can find the fossils of sea urchins. And you get something of the marvelous inspiration of Scripture. He pushed up the dry land from the bed of the ocean, gave us somewhere to live. But if he'd stopped there and just sort of pushed it up and said, there you are, there's a dry land to live on, we would be dead. Because we can't live on a dry land. Not many weeks ago, I flew over the Sahara Desert and I looked down, nobody lives there. It's dry land, it's pushed up from the ocean bed, but you can't live there. Because dry land needs water again for life. And so God, in his amazing mercy, lifts millions of tons of water from the sea, purifies it, and drops it gently enough not to hurt us on the dry land. He manages it. It doesn't do it like clockwork. It doesn't do it by itself. If God was not awake, the sun would not have risen this morning. And so he made it and he manages it. That gives him the right to own it. I can think of no better reasons. Our maker and our manager says all the produce and all the people in this planet are mine. Cattle on a thousand hills, all the silver and the gold is mine. That lovely psalm which Philip read to us, if I were hungry, I would not tell you. I would not tell you. I've got enough to look after myself. It's all mine. It's all mine. So let's move on then to the second section. Interesting, by the way, that the Jews sang Psalm 24 every Sunday morning. Did you know that? The Jews have a psalm which they sing every morning. It's a different one each morning. And on Sunday morning, they always sing Psalm 24. But remember that for Jews, that's not the day of worship. It is the first day of work in the week. And Psalm 24 is for those who are going to work. So tomorrow morning, as you go up by train to London or wherever, just say to yourself, the earth is the Lord's. Everything and everyone in it. Those people sitting behind the Financial Times opposite, they belong to the Lord. Those fields I can see out there, they belong to the Lord. Those factories, every bit of raw material going into those factories belongs to the Lord. It's an exciting, it transforms the world for you. Now, when God made all this planet and its produce and its people, he looked down from heaven and he looked at it all and he said, that's very good. That's very good. Not even a man would say that today, much less God. And he looks down at the way we've grabbed it and squabbled over it and fought over it and killed each other by the million for its produce and for its land. When you think 30 million dead in World War II, even more than that dead in Russia alone, since the communists came to power, you consider it. God looks down and he says, that's not so good. In fact, that's very bad. And even men are saying, I don't know what the world's coming to. It's a dreadful place, dreadful situation. So God looked down and he said, out of all that world which has gone so bad, I'm going to keep one little place good, as it was originally. And he chose a little hilly ridge to try and give you the feel of it if you haven't been. If you chop the hog's back off at the point where the A3 cuts through it, the hog's back from the A3 down to here, that's about the size and shape of the ridge which he chose. He chose out of all the land in the world a little patch the size of Wales where three continents, Europe, Asia and Africa meet. And this little land, he said, now that's going to be my land. All the land is mine, but this is going to be a holy land. And the word holy means the word healthy. That's why he chose a hilly land and not a swamp or a low-lying river delta, which is where human civilization invariably grows. In fact, I've told you that if God allowed the polar ice caps to melt, the oceans would rise by 200 feet and almost every major city in the world would go under, but Jerusalem would be safe. He chose it up in the hills, much healthier than the low-lying delta and swamp where civilization began at the Tigris and Euphrates and the Nile. He said, this is to be my healthy land, my holy land. And the people in that land were exactly the same as anybody everywhere else, indeed worse because they'd had more blessing and a better chance. And so out of that land he kept one hill, less than a mile long, one ridge. And he said, that's my holy hill. That's the place I'm going to meet you. I'll only meet you in a holy place. And so there was a holy hill, and on it stood the holy place, and inside the holy place was the Holy of Holies. Just one hill out of the whole planet that God was trying to keep right. Very precious place to every Jew and to every Gentile too. Now comes the question, who could possibly step on that hill? He that has clean hands and a pure heart, and that rules me out for a start, and I think it rules every one of you out. That's the problem. How is God going to keep that hill clean? How is he going to keep it as it was meant to be? It's like an operating theater. Can you imagine somebody going into his garden and spreading it with muck and then digging hard and weeding and then marching off to his friend who is a surgeon in an operating theater and rubbing his hands and going in, how are you getting on? I've had a good day. Can you imagine it? You wouldn't go into an operating theater with dirty hands. You watch the surgeon scrub even his nails out. The slightest bit of bacteria could be death. If you were invited to Buckingham Palace, would you go with grubby hands to shake the hand of the Queen? If you're going to meet the King of Kings, the first thing is clean hands. And hands are a symbol of what we've done, our work, our leisure, what we've done underhandedly. That's an interesting term, isn't it? Underhand. Clean hands. But you know, the Queen would only be bothered about your clean hands if she got her white gloves dirty through shaking hands with you. But God goes further still. He doesn't look at clean hands. He looks inside as well. Notice he does look at the outside. I've heard some preachers say he's not bothered about the outside. He is. He's bothered about hands. And cleanliness is next to godliness. But he's also bothered about hearts. He's not impressed with appearances where they're not matched with something inside. He that has clean hands and a pure heart. And the man who wrote this psalm had neither. Who will ever get into that holy hill? Who'll ever be able to meet God? Who'll ever be able to climb that hill? And we shall probably ride up in a bus next Thursday or Friday on that ridge and think nothing of it. But if we'd been alive in David's day, we'd have thought twice. We'd have been frightened stiff about going on that hill. You'd be safer walking into an asbestos factory full of dust than going into the presence of a holy God as a sinner. Who can ascend that hill? Who can scale those heights? And if you manage to reach them and it's uphill work to make yourself good, even if you managed it, who could stay there? Who could stand in his presence? Who could climb that high anyway? But even if you could you keep it up? Could you keep it up? Could you stand there? Never. Never. Purity in heart is here defined in terms of two more things. One, those who have not based their life on things that don't ring true. In Authorized Version, he has not lifted up his soul to vanity. The word soul means life. It doesn't mean the spiritual side of us, it means life. And the word vanity means hollow, hollow. And this means somebody who hasn't based his life on such hollow things that he's become an unreal person. One of the plastic people of today, who's based their life on such toys, such baubles, such idols, that ultimately he finishes up a hollow, unreal person. A person who's only on the outside. Do you know what I mean? A person whose heart isn't in what he says or what he does. A person who's doing it for the sake of appearance, for the sake of the neighbors. He who has not lifted up his soul to vanity, based his life on things that don't ring true. Because what you build on, you build in. And if you build your life on hollow things, you become a hollow person. If you live in a plastic world, you become a plastic person. And the other definition of pure in heart given here is a man of his word. A man whose word is as good as his bond, who if he makes a promise, keeps it. Because God is a God of truth. To be pure in heart is to say what you mean and let your yes be yes and your no be no. Now who? There's the question, who? There isn't a single soul in this building this morning who could walk up that hill in the days of King David. By a special concession, only one man once per year was allowed in, and it wasn't King David. And it was only a concession. He had no right to be there. Oh, who'll do it? Who? The admission is pretty high. But if you could do it, if you could be holy as he was holy, if you could be perfect as he was perfect, then you would receive God's approval, which would mean two things. He would succor you and he would support you. He would succor you by blessing your family, your work, your relationships, everything. You would receive blessing from God. And more than that, he would vindicate you, because we're in a world where people attack you, where they criticize, libel, slander, try to attack you. And he would protect you and prove you to be in the right. If you could only reach that height, he would defend you against anyone. That's what it says here. The Lord would save us from our critics. He would do all that for us, and that's why we need to go find him. Because we need succor. There are situations which need his blessing, which are beyond us. Life is too much to cope with. There are situations in which we need his support, when we feel that others are against us and we need somebody to stand for us. And he will do both, provided we've got clean hands and a pure heart. There's the dilemma. Such, says the psalmist, is the generation that seek God, that go looking for God. This is the real generation gap, you know. There are only two generations, the generations that seek God and the generation that doesn't. And the biggest gap is between those two generations, and they're not age gaps. Such is the generation that goes looking for God, because frankly, unless you are in this condition, who's going to go looking for God? You would keep right away from a holy hill, if you could. You need his succor, you need his support, and you maybe ask him for that, but you wouldn't seek him. You wouldn't seek him. You would seek his blessing, and you would say, and unbelievers say it, well, God bless. Comedians say it at the end of their act. Good night and God bless you. Everybody says that. They want the blessing, but such is the generation of those who seek God, because until you're fit for God's company, the last person you want to spend time with is God. It's too uncomfortable. It's too disturbing. That's what Jacob did. He met God face to face, and that's why he's mentioned here. He had an immediate encounter with a holy God, and do you know what happened? He limped for the rest of his life. He was lamed. His leg was pulled out of joint as he struggled and wrestled with God, and for the rest of his life, you could always tell Jacob, limping along. He limped away from that encounter. He came off worst. And those who want to seek God know that they will wrestle, and that God will have to defeat them and break them in. So the only generation that seeks God are those who really want to climb that hill and want to be fit for his company. The rest don't bother. We may well ask the question then, who? Who? Do you know my answer? If I were living in David's day, my answer would be very simply, nobody. Nobody. That's why the Old Testament is not the gospel. That's why the Old Testament is not good news. If the Old Testament tells me I've got to have clean hands, which means my conduct has got to be faultless, and if the Old Testament tells me I've got to have a pure heart, that my character must be flawless, before I can dare to climb that hill, much less stand in his presence, before I can have his blessing, before he can vindicate me, before I can see him face to face and have a personal relationship with him. If that is so, that is bad news, because nobody can climb that hill, not one single soul. But you know, this is where the New Testament comes in. It reverses the Old Testament. And the New Testament would read Psalm 24 in this order, verse 6, 5, 4, 3. And when you read it in that order, listen, it says, those who seek the Lord will be saved by him, vindicated, justified, blessed, and given clean hands and a pure heart. And that's good news. It's just put it the other way around. And that's why preaching the Old Testament alone is bad news. For the Old Testament says, when you're good enough, you can go up to God. The New Testament says, God came down to you and accepted you as you are, and is going to lift you there. Not because he's lowered his standards, but because he's going to lift you to them. That's grace. Law came by Moses. And law bangs you down. Law says, don't you dare come near God like that. Law says, get away until you're holy. But grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. And grace says, come. And sinners start climbing that hill. And do you know that was the very hill on which Abraham offered up Isaac and nearly killed Isaac? It was the very hill where that happened. And Abraham, when he was about to kill his own son, God said, stop! The angel held his hand, and when he turned round, he saw a sheep with its head in thorns. And he offered the sheep up instead. And you know, centuries later, 2,000 years later, on the same hill, the Lamb of God, with his head caught in a ring of thorns, was offered up. And God had provided Jehovah Jireh. And that's the holy hill referred to here. And sinners now climb it, not to offer themselves or their sons, but they climb it to see God offer his son. It's the same hill. They climb it not to go to the Holy of Holies, they climb it to go to the cross. And they start as they are. And then God begins to lift them. I move on quickly to the third and last section of the psalm, verses 7 to 10. The holy hill is a special place for some. In the Old Testament, none. But in the New Testament, all who will come. Now let's look at the supreme place for one man. There's a change of tone. We should almost have paused there, perhaps, and had a few moments' silence. But will you do that at home? We now look at the glorious gates that are going to open for one person. You almost have to shout these verses, certainly sing them, as the choir is going to do in a moment. Fling wide the gates! There's a change from the serious to the joyful, from what could be disturbing and depressing to something that's terribly exciting and stimulating. First of all, our invitation, it's a call to the people to open up. You know, when Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth II ever goes to the City of London, she has to stop at the Temple Bar. Did you know this? And at the Temple Bar, someone shouts out, "Who is there?" And the reply is given, "The Queen of England." She's allowed to pass the Temple Bar. I've sometimes wondered if that goes back to Psalm 24. Because, you know, so much of our national heritage is based on the Book of Psalms. The lion and the unicorn of the royal arms come from Psalm 22. The authorized version, instead of lion and bull, had lion and unicorn, and that was included in our royal coat of arms. Another psalm, Psalm 45, gave us our national anthem, "God Save Our Gracious Queen." And I wonder if this goes back to Psalm 24. Who's there? Who's outside waiting to come in? It's the King. Open up. Now, there are two things described to be open, I believe. I don't think it's just parallelism referring to the same entrance. I believe the gates belong to the city and the doors belong to the citadel within the city. And old gates had to be lifted up. Indeed, many large doors had to be. They were counterbalanced, they were in grooves, and they were pulled up with ropes like a portcullis for defense. They weren't easily opened, and they were only openable from the inside. Fling wide the city gates. Open up. Be lifted up. Be lifted up, O gates. And it would be the people inside who'd have to lift them up. But the citadel doors have to be opened up from the outside. And I get a strong impression as I read these verses, I can see very clearly an ancient city with a very thick, stout wall and a gate in it that had to be hauled up with ropes. And right in the heart of the city, an empty palace. And a prince has been away for years at the wars. And now he's on his way back victorious. He's won the wars in distant lands and he's coming back. And the shout goes up, the King is coming. Up with the gate. Open up those ancient doors. That word ancient gave me that impression. Why ancient there? As if they hadn't been used in a long time. As if the palace had been lying empty and the King had been away. And now he's coming back victorious. That's the impression I get distinctly. I think that fits. But if we then ask the fundamental question, who is this king? We can answer it by asking, when did this come true? And here, I've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 answers. And you pays your money and takes your choice, and I don't mind which you take of these 7. I know which I take, and I'll probably hint at that, but I'll leave you to take whichever you want. Who is this King of Glory? The Lord. Now, the word Lord in the Old Testament in capital letters means Jehovah, Yahweh, I am. It's a name. If we take it solely to mean God, Jehovah, the God of the Jews, then there are two possible occasions, one of which to my mind is just nonsense, but it came from no less a person than the blind poet Milton in Paradise Lost. And he thought this psalm referred to the day when God went back to heaven having created the earth in 6 days. And if you read Milton's Paradise Lost, it's there imagined that the angels shout, fling wide the gates, God's been so busy on earth making earth, now he's coming back to heaven. I just don't think that's what's referred to at all, but it's a possible, and you can take it if you wish. Much more meaningful to me is this. On Wednesday evening, some of us will be in a bus, and we shall pass a little village on our way from the airport to the place we're staying called Kiryat Jearim. And it is the place where the Ark of the Covenant rested when David had defeated the Philistines, rescued the Ark of the Covenant, which was the symbol of God's presence, and was bringing it back to Jerusalem. And a man called Uzzah dared to touch this holy thing and died of a heart attack immediately. And everybody was a bit scared, so they decided to leave the Ark at Kiryat Jearim for a bit. And then, a short while later, they brought it in triumph to Jerusalem. It was as if God was coming, having defeated the Philistines, having been mighty in battle, having been undefeated, having enabled David to come through victorious. Now the Ark, the presence of God, is being brought back into Jerusalem. Fling wide the gates. Open up the doors of the holy place inside. The Lord of hosts coming in. And David was just so excited that day that he just danced before the Lord. His wife didn't approve of dancing in religion, but I'm sure the Lord did. And they brought the ark in with tremendous joy. And I think that would be the original setting of this psalm, would you not? Open up. And David, coming with the ark towards the holy hill, has two feelings. One is a feeling of hesitation. I don't have clean hands or a pure heart. I shouldn't be climbing that hill. And yet then there is the triumph. Oh, but the king can go in. So open up the gates. We'll bring the ark in. I think that's when it was written. But I'm not going to limit the meaning of this phrase there. The answer to the question, who can be broadened? If it isn't Jehovah alone, who else could it be? Well, there's one other. And his name is Jesus. For Jesus of Nazareth is Jehovah Sabaoth, the Lord of hosts. The titles that are given to Jehovah in the Old Testament are given to Jesus in the New Testament. That's why we call him the Lord. And when you look at Jesus' life, there are 5 possible occasions when this psalm is appropriate. There is first the occasion on Palm Sunday when he rode into Jerusalem, down from the Mount of Olives, up the other side of the Kidron Valley, in at the Golden Gate, the eastern gate to the temple area, and came right in triumphant. Who is this? It's Jesus of Nazareth, but it was the King of Glory. That's one possible. The second possible one you'll find in what's called the Golden Legend in Southwest France. If you go to Southwest France, ask about the Golden Legend. It is a legend, and the legend is that for the 3 days Jesus spent in Hades after his death, the angels kept shouting, fling wide the gates. And the gates of hell on the 3rd day gave way. And he rose from the dead and came back to earth. That's a second possibility. Doesn't convince me, partly because it's legend, but it's a possibility. The third possibility, and the one which the Christian church has made most of, is that this refers to the ascension. And Psalm 24 is sung in every Anglican church on Ascension Day. When he went up in the clouds like an eagle, no longer feeling like a worm on the cross, but like an eagle soaring through the clouds. He went up into heaven. And this psalm is sung on Ascension Day. Fling wide the gates. He led captivity captive. All authority in heaven and earth is now given to him. The King of Glory is coming back. Open up the doors of the citadel. Well, it's appropriate then. But I still don't think we've exhausted it. Fourthly, what about the day when he comes back? To this very hill. What about the day when his feet stand on the Mount of Olives again? The king has been absent. And he's been absent because he's been by the right hand of God until all his enemies are under his feet, even death. And when all his enemies are under his feet, he's coming back. And he will come back across the Kidron Valley. And he will come back, it says, he will suddenly return to his temple. And here is the most striking thing you know. Of all the gates in the city walls of Jerusalem, there is one that is bricked up. Just one. You can walk through every one of the others, and we shall do, but one is bricked up, and it's that golden gate, the east gate of the temple. And it's bricked up. Nobody really quite knows why. There are some explanations, but I'll give you the best one. Ezekiel said this 500 years or more before. Then he brought me back, in vision that is, to the outer gate of the temple which faces east, and it was shut. And he said to me, this gate shall remain shut. It shall not be opened, and no one shall enter by it, for the Lord, the God of Israel, has entered by it. Therefore it shall remain shut. Only the prince may come into it. Isn't it striking? Fling wide the gates. How appropriate it is when he comes back and comes to that very gate to enter his own temple on that holy hill. He's been away for so long. Open up the old doors. Let him in. But I still don't think we've exhausted it, you know. Why is it repeated at the end of Psalm 24? Twice it says, fling wide the gates, who's coming? Fling wide the gates, who's coming? Twice, why? Well, I believe there are two ascensions of Jesus. There's the one that happened 2,000 years ago when heaven welcomed the returned victor, but he went by himself. There's another ascension coming when he will enter heaven with all his saints. And the gates will be flung open for the King of Glory, the Lord of Hosts, and there'll be hosts. There'll be at least 1,000 million with him, even if he came this week. The Lord of Hosts is coming. Oh, when the saints go marching in. We're going to sing that right now, and then I'm going to take just 5 minutes more to apply the psalm personally. Oh, when the saints go marching in. Oh, when the saints go marching in, I want, oh Lord, I want to be among the number. It's not on your bulletin. When the saints go marching in, and we'll change one line each verse. Oh, when the saints go marching in. When they crown him Lord of all. Oh. Oh, when all knees bow at his name. Sing Psalm 24 again on that day. Now just less than 5 more minutes, just to share with you 3 personal challenges from this psalm. It's been an impersonal psalm, looking at the universe, looking at mankind, looking at the world we live in. Now I want to look at you and to look at myself, and I want to look at the 3 points at 3 personal levels and give you a paradox, an apparent contradiction at each level. I want to challenge you at the material level. I want to challenge you at the moral level. And I want to challenge you at the mystical level. Here then are three simple paradoxes. Paradox number one, everything is ours and nothing is ours. The material challenge at the personal level of Psalm 24 verses 1 and 2 is this. You are not the owner of anything you possess. The only person who can be robbed in the strictest sense is God himself, because everything belongs to him. And therefore my challenge is to sit loose to your possessions, to let material things be second in your life, or even lower down, and to realize that everything you have is his, not mine, not even ours, but his. If you do not think that way, and if you start thinking, look what I've got, the Lord may say to you, you fool, tonight you lose it. But if nothing is ours, everything is ours. Listen, the Lord Jesus made the world. Without him was not anything made. The Lord Jesus manages the world. He upholds all things by the word of his power. And if the earth is the Lord's and I am the Lord's, then all things are mine in Christ. And I shall inherit the earth. Isn't that a lovely paradox? Nothing is mine and everything is mine in Jesus Christ. That's the material challenge, to regard nothing as yours and to rejoice that everything is yours. The paradox at the moral level is this. None of us are fit to be accepted by God, but he accepts us as we are. And I want to underline that very deeply this morning. God's standards are far too strict for human nature as it is. We might just manage to get the outside clean, which is the one that we usually get more concerned about. We will certainly not get the inside clean. So none of us is fit to stand in heaven before God. That's what makes us a little hesitant about going there too soon. But he accepts us as we are. And he imputes Christ's righteousness to us, and then he imparts it to us, if we're hungry and thirsty for it. So that when we get to heaven, we shall be holy, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is. After all, if I went to heaven as I am, I would spoil it for everybody else, most of all for God. Yet he's willing to accept me and start there. And the third paradox at the mystical level. This Lord is almighty. He's never been defeated in battle. He has overcome strongholds. He can batter his way into any city. Yet he waits for the gates to be opened from the inside. That's the mystical level at which I would challenge you. Revelation 3:20 must be the best known text in the New Testament. It's the picture of a king knocking at a door. And Holman Hunt, who painted the famous picture, The Light of the World, in a Yule farmyard, it's a barn door in Yule in Surrey, he showed a weed-covered door with the ivy having grown over it, showing that it was an old door, an ancient door that hadn't been opened in a long time. And he was saying the citadel in the heart of your life has been closed for a long time. Open it up. And even though this is the Lord who commands all the forces of the universe, who's strong and mighty in battle, the Lord of hosts, he still waits for the man inside to open up. Incredible. But as soon as I open the door of my heart, he flings wide the gates of heaven. These are the three challenges to you. At the material level, nothing is yours. But in the Lord, everything is yours. At the moral level, you're not fit to be here this morning, neither am I. But in the Lord, we're accepted as we are. At the mystical level, God could force his way into my life as easily as that. But he waits until I fling wide the gates. And if you haven't flung wide those gates before the gates of Hades close on you, the gates of heaven remain barred from the inside to you forever. Fling wide the gates. Open up those ancient doors and let the King of Glory in. Come and sing for us, choir.